Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. Welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up, why a record-breaking revenue month for the state could complicate the process of coming to a deal on a new budget.
And ASU's longtime groundskeeper looks back at his years caring for the university's athletic fields.
But first, earlier this year, Mexican migrant Carmelo Cruz Marcos was shot and killed by U.S. Border Patrol agent Kendrick Staheli. According to a witness, Staheli had screamed to Cruz Marcos that, quote, "This is America, MF-er," end quote. Another layer to the story that is concerning to some was the presence of one of the Border Patrol's critical incident teams. A couple of weeks ago, the Cochise County Attorney's Office decided it wouldn't bring any charges against Agent Staheli. Ryan Devereaux is an investigative reporter for The Intercept and is with me to talk about the story he wrote about the killing of Cruz Marcos. Ryan, how much does this particular incident offer bigger picture insights on how some members of the Border Patrol treat migrants?
In Mexico, in the state of Puebla, where Carmelo Cruz Marcos was from, this case is seen as a sort of representation of the way migrants are often treated crossing the border into the United States, treated with violence, sort of funneled into the most deadly regions of the border. It is not the case that, migrants are being shot and killed every day on the border. But each year here in Pima County, for example, the medical examiner's office is taking in anywhere from 160 to 165 sets of migrant remains from the desert. So there is a lot of suffering and a lot of loss of life that occurs on the border. And this case has come to symbolize some of the worst of that, especially in Mexico.
Early in your piece, talking about the Cochise County Attorney's Office that had insufficient evidence to bring charges against the Border Patrol agent. What was the reaction to that, considering the idea that it seems like, from reading your piece, that there was plenty of evidence to move forward? Is there concern that the Cochise County Attorney's Office didn't see what others were seeing or just had other reasons to not pursue this?
Yeah, if you read closely the declination letter that the Cochise County prosecutor released announcing that Agent Staheli would not be charged in this case, what he is saying is, two things. He's saying that a law enforcement official in Arizona can only use deadly force in cases where they feel that their life is threatened or the life of another person is threatened. And additionally, that Agent Staheli, enjoyed the same rights as any other person in Arizona when it comes to self-defense, which is to say that the prosecutor's office would need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was not in fear for his life. And what the prosecutor was saying is that there's only one person who knows what happened that night now, and that's Agent Staheli. And he told a version of events that the prosecutor found credible. And so that's where we end up on this. So in some sense, there's an argument implicit in what the prosecutor was saying, that the way that the law is structured here, I cannot bring charges against this agent because I can't prove that what he was saying is not true. Of course, if you read closely the investigative report, which was released by the Cochise County Sheriff's Department, there are a number of alarming claims in there that come from some of the men who were with Carmelo Cruz Marcos that night. Ultimately, those investigators came to the conclusion that that this was a case of self-defense. But obviously, this is a very complicated situation that is fundamentally a tragedy.
One of the witnesses said that he heard Agent Staheli say, "You're an America MF-er." Was this said to the county attorney's office to discuss that he actually may have said this kind of thing and that may indicate that he was not necessarily approaching this in a neutral way?
The county prosecutor's office does mention a sort of, I don't recall the exact language that they use, but an off-color comment that was made that was described by witnesses or companions, I should say, of Mr. Cruz's. And it's obviously clear that telling of those words being said was included in investigative reports that county investigators submitted to the attorney's office. So the attorney's office was well aware that these claims were made, that these words were used, according to Cruz's companions, by Agent Staheli in the moments immediately preceding the shooting. It comes up multiple times in different versions and different sort of accounts that some language along these lines was used immediately preceding the shooting.
What really stands out to you more and more about this particular situation? Because in reading it, it's alarming, but I also wonder if this happens more than we think.
I think it's the question of how these two men found themselves in this place in that moment in time, and how those two paths intersected and how it led to this tragedy. Because I think it is reflective of, you know, it's a cliche, but a very, very broken system that causes these kinds of interactions to happen that then can quickly spin into violence and, a father of three losing his life and you know, children growing up without their dad. I think a lot of things have to go wrong in order for that sort of sequence of events to unspool in the way that they did in this case. And like I said, you know, shootings do happen along the border. You know, violent, you know, killings of migrants are not unheard of, but there's a sort of slow violence that also unfolds on the border day after day, people trekking through the desert, dying of thirst, dying of exposure. And all of that, I believe, is, you know, reflects a system that is fundamentally broken. The other issue that I think is worth noting in this piece is that the Border Patrol's investigation or its role in the investigation of this incident involved these what are called critical incident teams. And there are these Border Patrol units that have been around for many, many years that are called to, you know, as the name suggests, critical incidents. Often these will be car chases that result in fatalities, but also shootings or cases of lethal force. And advocates along the border have sort of accused these units of conducting essentially unauthorized investigations into alleged abuses by the Border Patrol, and in some cases tampering with evidence, destroying the credibility of investigations. And in fact, as this investigation was unfolding, which included the involvement of a critical incident team, the chief of the Border Patrol, of Customs and Border Protection, Christopher Magnus, former police chief here in Tucson, announced that he was disbanding these units. So this could potentially be the last sort of known case in which one of these teams was used in a lethal force case.
That is Ryan Devereaux. He's an investigative journalist. We've been talking about his latest piece for The Intercept. Ryan, thank you for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Arizona brought in more money in April than in any previous month ever. Numbers from the Joint Legislative Budget Committee show state revenue topped $2 billion last month, which was far higher than projections. At the same time, state lawmakers are struggling to come to agreement on a new budget as the end of the fiscal year looms at the end of June. With me to talk about the new numbers from JLBC and what they may mean for the budget process is economist Alan McGuire. He's president of the McGuire Company and has spent a lot of time in state government. And Alan, first off, what do you make of the revenue numbers?
Well, first, April's always a pretty good month because you've got personal income tax payments coming in, right, in a lot of cases. And so it's a historically good month. And being the highest ever is not entirely surprising. First of all, there's been a long run of very good tax collections for about a year and a half or so. And secondly, the state is growing. So one would kind of expect that each year would be a little higher than the prior year in nominal dollar amounts. Plus, we've got a flash of inflation going on here. So all those sort of explain away why the number might be the highest ever in history.
So to you, then, it doesn't seem maybe as surprising as it would to somebody who maybe hasn't worked on state budgets for as long as you have, hasn't had as much experience in state government as you have.
No. Actually, Arizona, because of our tax structure the way it is, has a historically volatile general fund revenue. Our sales taxes go up and down because we don't tax food, the most stable part of sales. And our income tax historically has been progressive. And so therefore, more revenue is generated from the higher income households. And those higher income households have more volatile income because of the nature of Arizona's economy in many cases.
So you referenced the sales tax, and JLBC referenced the sales tax as well. It had another month of double-digit growth. That's 14 consecutive months of double-digit month year-over-year growth per month. What does that tell you about where Arizona's economy is right now?
Well, Arizona's economy is doing very, very well. We did not suffer nearly as badly as many other states during the pandemic lockdowns because we didn't lock down as severely as other places. Now, it certainly hurt our leisure and hospitality industry quite a bit, obviously, because travel was way down. But some other sectors performed quite well, and you can see that in some of the tax revenues. Construction, for example, held up very well through the entire period. I would expect sales taxes to be up quite a bit for two reasons. Number one, we've got a bunch of inflation, and we see that in prices. So that that pound of bananas you bought for $2 a year ago is now $2.50. So nominally, you would see the sales tax go up in the same sort of fashion. That's one thing. And then the other thing is we tend to keep forgetting that for about a year and a half, the federal government basically flew helicopters over the U.S. and dropped money out of them. And so we have all this money that's flooded into households. I heard three of the major bank presidents or CFOs in the last week comment on the fact that household savings and checking accounts are at historically high levels. Hmm. So people have saved a lot of that pandemic aid, and then they've spent it over time. And more recently, they spent it on goods because there were no services available until just the last few months.
So I want to ask you about what's going on at the Capitol when budget writers, lawmakers, the governor's staff, those folks see these numbers. Does it make their job to craft a budget easier? Does it make it harder?
Mark, it is always harder to close down the budget process when there's money on the table. When there's no money, it's relatively easy. The budget committees and the leadership can say to their fellow members, got no money, can't give you what you want. When there is money, there will always be requests and demands far in excess of the available amount. Tell them you have $10 million, you'll get $100 million worth of requests.
So I guess, you know, there has been a lot of talk about, you know, the state's got this, what, $5 billion or so surplus. I know folks at the Capitol don't like to use the word surplus, but extra money, and a lot of folks want more money for education, for, you know, social safety net programs. Name your project, and there are people who want extra money for it. When the state reports that there's another $2 billion coming in 1 month, does that just up the requests?
It does. It does. And, one of the hard parts of this process right now is legislators and interest groups who drive legislators tend to think of general fund revenue like perishable fruit. If you don't spend it today, it will be gone. It is actually quite the opposite. Whatever you don't spend this year is there next year. And so the worst possible time to make big policy decisions is in the waning days of a legislative session. Everybody's tired, they're overwrought, tempers are on edge, and you see that almost every session, and not a good time to be making big policy decisions. We did that last session to some regret, and I think, frankly, they could leave that money sit. Think about it for a year. It's a novel concept, but think about it for a year and figure out what should you do with that money. And by the way, a year from now, you're going to have a much better sense of how much of that money is really ongoing, not guessed at ongoing, but really ongoing, and how much is one time. And then spend the one-time stuff for one-time things, and then think about what long-term programmatic changes you want to make in state government for the remainder.
So I know how much economists love looking into crystal balls and making big predictions. So I'm going to ask you to look into yours for a moment. How do you think the budget situation ends this year for the legislature with just over a month till the end of the fiscal year?
I'm not sure. I think what I would be tempted to suggest to them, and I say this cautiously, is that they might take some of the funds that they've got, appropriate them into dedicated funds. So if they want to spend some more on K-12, put a couple $100 million or whatever that number is, come up with a number, put that in a dedicated fund and set it aside and say that we're going to talk about that maybe after the November elections or sometime from now when you'll be able to. So you give them half a loaf, if that makes sense, right? You say, yes, we'll use this money for your purpose, but not until we think about how we want to use it, what we really want to do with it. And you can do the same thing, for example, for water infrastructure augmentation. You could put a pot of money aside and decide how to do it. Don't try to design a system in the waning hours of the legislature that may or may not work. We've got a lot of bad law written that way, and this is not the time to do that. So that might help them, and that would help them get the area of dispute to a more manageable size. And then they can make some final decisions. And people could take credit. Legislators could go back and run for re-election on the fact that I got X millions of dollars put aside for K-12 or water or pension funds or anything. And the other thing is that it isn't like the state of Arizona has no debt. We could pay down a whole bunch of debt, most notably our pension debt. I thank them and I appreciate what they've done so far, but they could do far more to buy down that pension debt and get that obligation off the back of future taxpayers.
All right, that is Alan McGuire, president of the McGuire Company. He's been involved in state government for many years. Alan, as always, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
My pleasure, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, printing paper with a letterpress isn't just a thing of the past.
It's a very analog thing to do. And, you know, today it's nice to do something with your hands other than type.
We'll take you to Hazel and Violet, a shop that makes prints the old-fashioned way.
But first, unemployment numbers in the U.S. remain low, but since the pandemic began, the nation has been in the midst of a worker shortage, and people continue to leave their current positions to try something new, creating other holes to fill. So is this the time to see a bipartisan push for expanded guest worker programs? Juan Garcia, professor emeritus in the U of A's history department, is with me to talk about that. Professor, let's begin with a brief history lesson. How vital have guest worker programs been for the U.S. economy in the past, and how successful have they been?
The first guest worker program that many people don't know about occurred during World War I, when there was a labor shortage of railroad workers. And so Mexico and the United States agreed to have a guest worker program that lasted about a year, year and a half, and maybe about 20 or 25,000 guest workers came. It did not work out well. The United States had promised Mexico that none of the workers brought here would be forced to serve in the army. And as it turned out, they were. Furthermore, many of the contracts were not kept in good faith. And so Mexico became a little bit disillusioned with the guest worker program with the United States. But on the other side, the guest worker program began to prime the pipe for Mexicans who wanted to come work in the United States for higher wages. And then, of course, we had the more famous 1942 agreement, the Bracero program, that lasted until 1954. And that had mixed results. Mexico wanted to send workers over because there was a large population and high unemployment, but they were not satisfied with the way that many of the workers were treated. In fact, Mexico ultimately banned Texas from receiving guest workers because of their continued violation of the agreement.
Is there reason to believe that what Chambers of Commerce wants and making up for the worker shortage, is there reason to think that there is nuance to be found so that a guest worker program could somehow be put into effect? And let me ask you this, based on the history, do you think the guest worker program now would be something that could be implemented and implemented in a way that actually would be beneficial to workers and companies?
The Chamber of Commerce believes that there's always a labor shortage, and there has been a fairly effective guest worker program in terms of the agricultural sector. They come in under what is known as the H-2A visa program. They're here temporarily. They're hired to work in the agricultural sector. There are certain regulations that govern hours, working conditions, transportation, etc. Now there's a need, of course, for non-agricultural workers, and there is a program for that called the H-2B program. But again, it's for low wage workers. It's not for the skilled workers that are needed in manufacturing. So in 2013, when the discussion between the so-called eight that occurred in the Senate over immigration and under the Obama administration, the Chamber of Commerce really pushed hard for a program that would allow skilled non-agricultural workers to come to the United States. There was disagreement in terms of the numbers. Furthermore, there was resistance from workers' rights organizations, as well as the labor unions, who argued that there was plenty of labor available in the United States, but only if they were willing to pay a living wage. So that didn't exactly really work out for the better. If there were to be a guest worker program today, I think the same issues would arise. Workers' rights organizations and labor organizations would say, if you pay higher wages, there will not be a labor shortage. If you bring in guest workers, that means that you're preferring non-American workers to American workers and discriminates against them and undermines unionization efforts. The Chamber of Commerce says, but without these workers, we're not able to have a strong and robust economy. And there's also differences in terms of enforcement, in terms of the numbers that would be brought in, and in terms of past experiences involving the treatment of workers here in the United States.
I think many people are familiar with the guest worker visas related to agriculture, to factory and manufacturing jobs, but we're seeing a widening job gap in what would be considered labeled as a white collar sector in particular. Is there a way to think about guest worker programs expanding beyond how we traditionally think of them?
Yes, there is. I think that in some cases, guest worker programs are expanded to bring in highly educated and skilled people from abroad, the Middle East, India, people who are skilled at technology or at other kinds of jobs requiring a high level of education. I know that some of the students who come here from the University of Arizona come under those kinds of visas because it's hoped that not only will they be trained here, for example, we have a lot of Middle Eastern students who come here to study arid land studies. And it's the hope that maybe some of them will remain here and help bolster that labor force.
Based on your knowledge of the history and then what's going on today over the last few decades, is the reaction to this sort of thing still cyclical, or are we seeing something different? It used to seem like when the economy was down, then we can't possibly bring in workers from other countries because they're going to steal jobs from Americans, et cetera. And I know that is still being discussed today, but is it being discussed today, do you think, more out of hostility as opposed to fear of losing a job? Is it actually hostility toward other humans?
Yeah, I think that the rhetoric has really ramped up in terms of anti-immigrant verbiage. We've had the recent experience with the caravans under the previous administration, of course. Asylum seekers were denied entry and families were separated. And so this whole discussion of guest worker programs, immigration, security along the border have become so entangled that it's very difficult to sort of separate it out and look at the pros and cons of each one of those issues and look at how we can establish an effective guest worker program that will benefit the economy of the country that's sending the workers, as well as benefit the needs of the labor force in the United States. And the question is, how do we determine where the labor needs are? Is it due to the lack of labor supply with the necessary skills, or is it due to low wages, or is it due to other factors? And right now, discussions that revolve around a rational examination of the facts is sort of interwoven with all of these other anti-immigrant rhetoric that's going on. And so until we move beyond that, I think that any kind of a successful discussion about the pros and cons and the necessity of a guest worker program are going to be stalled.
That is Juan Garcia, Professor Emeritus in the University of Arizona's History Department, and you are listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Tempe-based Carvana is having a rough few months. The used vehicle retailer, perhaps best known for its car vending machine, lost around $500 million in the first quarter of this year and laid off more than 10% of its workforce. At the same time, it paid more than $2 billion to buy a car auction service. Last August, the company's stock price was more than $370. Today, it's right around $30. With me to talk about the state of Carvana and where it might go from here is CJ Moore, a staff reporter covering used vehicle and wholesale auctions for Automotive News in Detroit. And CJ, Carvana has had a pretty tough run as of late. What are folks saying about what's going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's safe to say there's a number of folks in the auto industry who are looking at Carvana, just sort of trying to parse what its future looks like, whether that be, you know, Carvana's investors or, you know, people who compete with Carvana, like dealers, traditional dealers, for instance. Some of them don't think that Carvana's business model is necessarily sustainable, but it honestly remains to be seen where Carvana goes from here and how and if it bounces back. Analysts I spoke with told me that Carvana could very well right itself, especially if it stabilizes growth and reduces its cash burn in the coming quarters.
So the company lost roughly $500 million in the first quarter of this year. And I would imagine that that has some folks a little bit concerned, and probably including people who work or maybe used to work for Carvana.
Yeah, absolutely. So Carvana had what it called a challenging first quarter, and its CEO, Ernie Garcia, said it looked like the industry environment was deteriorating throughout that period. I mean, it sold more than 105,000 vehicles in the quarter, 14% more than it did in the same period last year. That was fewer vehicles than it planned for, which led to higher costs and lower profits per vehicle. And, you know, Carvana said high used vehicle prices and interest rates helped hinder how many vehicles it ended up selling. It's certainly a different story for the company now than it was 1 year ago.
Does it seem as though there are any other factors that are contributing to this besides those that the company's leadership is talking about?
Yeah, I mean, Carvana was definitely one of the companies that was on the up and up during the earlier days of the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, several folks were buying cars online because they didn't want to risk getting COVID-19 by taking a trip into a traditional dealership. And so in 2020 and 2021, Carvana and these other retailers that sell used cars online got increased attention. But now some investors and analysts are thinking that that early pandemic sales bubble has popped and Carvana, like other companies, is feeling the effects.
One of the other things that Carvana has been involved in is a multi-billion dollar acquisition of a dealer-to-dealer car auction service. I'm wondering, given the other problems that Carvana is having, looking back, you know, obviously hindsight is 2020, was this deal maybe not made at the right time for Carvana?
I mean, certainly there are some, I think, investors who were sort of wary when that deal was announced back in late February. And then, you know, also wary when it closed on May 10th. But Carvana is saying that in the long run, that purchase of ADESA US, which is the number two auction house in the country, physical auction house in the country, Carvana is saying that that will be beneficial to its business in the long run. You know, for one thing, Carvana has a lot of conviction that ADESA US is real estate. They hope will allow them to eventually get way more vehicles ready for sale each year and even help generate smoother cash flow. And if they see better cash flow, that'll end up helping them, you know, pay the purchase price for ADESA US, which was, you know, $2.2 billion. And for another thing, that purchase includes 56 sites across the US, and acquiring those widens their logistics network, which basically means it puts them within closer reach of more customers. That's also something that they've been wanting.
At a time, though, when the company seems to be struggling to sell enough cars, is adding more inventory the right approach?
Right. That's certainly a question that's been raised by investors. And I mean, Carvana did take on more debt to pay for ADESA US. And that debt has an interest rate of 10.25%, which is high, and it can't be paid for at least 5 years. So some investors certainly were wary of that purchase price and Carvana's cash burn there.
So what does all this mean for Carvana's workforce? We saw that they say they plan to lay off about 2,500 employees, about 12% of its workforce. What does that mean for the company as a whole, and what does it mean for its operations here in the Phoenix area?
Yeah, absolutely. So earlier this month, you know, Carvana cut about 2,500 jobs, more than 10% of its workforce. The employees cut were primarily folks in operations groups. You know, Carvana called the decision extremely difficult, but it believes cutting those jobs will help balance out its sales volumes and staffing levels and allow it to go back to what it calls a more efficient growth pattern. You know, it was growing pretty quickly earlier in the pandemic, as we've seen. But now, you know, investors, analysts are saying, you know, it's got to stabilize its sort of growth in order to, I would say, be more sustainable in the long run.
How closely do you think analysts and others in the automotive world will be watching Carvana specifically over the next couple of quarters?
I mean, probably very closely. I think a lot of eyes are on Carvana at the moment. I know mine are. I certainly eagerly await Carvana's second quarter earnings report. I think that's due in either late July or early August. But this is a major disruptor of a company. Automotive News puts out a top 100 used vehicle retailers by sales volume in the United States each year, and Carvana is number two on that. So a lot of eyes are on it. A lot of people are waiting to see if it, you know, sort of retains its status that it had as this major company that was just disrupting things, you know.
All right. That is CJ Moore, staff reporter covering used vehicles in the wholesale auction industry for Automotive News. CJ, thanks for walking me through this. I appreciate it.
Sure thing, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Whether it's a weekday intra-squad practice or the Super Bowl, most of us don't pay much attention to what the playing surface for a sporting event looks like or how it feels. But for the players, the grass or turf needs to be in great shape to help them avoid injuries. And for the biggest games beaming into millions of homes, the TV networks want the field to look bright and colorful. Brian Johnson was in charge of making games at ASU live up to those expectations, and he's been involved with the preparation for 26 Super Bowls as well. Johnson retired earlier this month as university's manager of athletic grounds facilities, closing out 37 years at ASU. I spoke with him earlier and began by asking about the balancing act of having a good, safe playing surface that is also attractive.
First and foremost, you want the field to play well. And I feel like we've done a good job at ASU with providing a good field, and the Super Bowls that I've been involved with have all been great. But there is a growing trend towards really the aesthetics of a field. For some reason, people just have taken to that recently, and that's become part of the field preparation for a game. And I really enjoy that balance of creating a safe field for a big game, whether it's a Super Bowl or an ASU game or a bowl game. I think it's a trend that's only going to continue for many years to come.
Did that make the job even more kind of interesting and fascinating for you that, yeah, you knew how to do all sorts of stuff and this gave you a chance to branch out more?
Yeah, I've always enjoyed painting. You know, there's many jobs that go with groundskeeping, you know, and you're mowing fields and fertilizing and fixing irrigation repairs and maintaining engines. But I would have to say that painting is probably my favorite part of the job. I just really enjoyed painting logos on the field. It's just really cool for us to come up with an idea on the ground crew, thinking, well, this will be really cool on the field, and taking that to our administration and them giving us their blessing and saying, yeah, you know, that I think that will look good. So when you can take an idea that you had and then 6 days later you're watching it on TV and seeing what you envisioned in your head on the TV screen and getting comments from people, that's a very rewarding part of the job and very cool.
So you mentioned painting, and I want you to dig into that more, because when you're talking about actual natural grass and you're putting paint on it, I mean, obviously you need to have it something where you want the design to look great, you want the paint to look great, but you don't want to hurt the grass. How do you manage that?
We have to be very careful here. Some other schools some other teams that do a lot of resodding during the year don't really have to worry about that grass health. You know, they kind of paint a little bit extra and it looks great for their games. And they can do that because they know in 3 weeks they're going to resod their end zones or do something like that. So we don't typically do that. We've had the same sod on our field now ever since construction ended. So it's been about 3 or 4 years. So we have to worry about long-term health of the grass. But I feel like we do a really good job the way we paint and not loading it up in certain areas. Just the designs that we create. We kind of mix things up from week to week so that we're not painting the same thing over and over. And we paint the day before the game. We don't, I think a lot of other schools maybe start on Wednesday and, you know, paint Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We do all our painting just the day before the game. And that way we can put out a little bit of a lighter coat, but it's still going to look just as bright because we're doing it, right before the game, you know, just the day before the game. So it's a battle between grass health and aesthetics. But I think that we've had a real good system in place for providing a safe field, but then also, a nice, bright painted surface.
Are there built-in greater challenges like I would expect there to be in the kind of climate we have?
Well, I don't want to let the secret out, but people over the years have given me a lot of credit for maintaining grass here in the desert. But really, we have an ideal situation, an ideal climate for the type of variety of grass we have. It's a hybrid Bermuda grass that really thrives in the summertime, especially monsoon season in July and August. It just really thrives in that, and it can survive the May, June heat, and it does really well. And then when we come to football season, we overseed that with perennial ryegrass. And really, we have a beautiful climate for that overseed process where in October and November, that rye seed is germinating on the field and growing at a really perfect temperature for it. I just say thank you when people say, you know, boy, you really have it tough growing grass in the desert. I don't really try to tell them, well, it's really not that hard.
For many years before the Cardinals moved to Glendale, they played at Sun Devil Stadium, and obviously ASU's football team played there as well. What were some of the challenging weekends you had back in those days with ASU playing on Saturday and the Cardinals on Sunday?
Well, it was 18 years. not that I'm counting, or not a few years.
Right.
It was 18 years, 18 long years. Everybody was busy. Everybody in our office was busy. But as a groundskeeper, you know, there were some weekends where we worked 40 hours on the weekend and then turned around and we're right there at the beginning on Monday at, you know, crack of dawn on Monday, you know, to do it all over again. And a lot of overnight paint jobs, get in early on Saturday for an ASU game, stay late, and then repaint the field overnight for a Cardinal game, and then work all day the next day and stay late working on the field after that game. It really made me into a good groundskeeper. I think when you can figure out ways to keep the field looking good in that kind of situation, that's kind of like the ultimate test for a groundskeeper is maintaining a football field with two teams playing on it. But one weekend that stands out to me is ASU. We beat Iowa on a Saturday and it rained and poured the day, you know, before the game, you know, like hours before the game, it was just pouring out. And then it kind of dried up a little bit during the game and ASU won and the fans were on the goalpost trying to tear them down. And it's probably like 1 a.m. before we got everybody cleared off the field. And then we had to do a real quick paint job. The Cardinals were playing the Patriots the next day. So I think we finished painting at like about 4:30 in the morning and everybody was starting to fall asleep on the shop floor, literally like with drool coming out of their mouth, sleeping on a cement floor. And I saw on the radar another big red cell headed our way. So we quick rushed out to the field and put the rain tarp on. I think we had 3 of the 4 pieces on when lightning struck right outside the stadium and it just started coming down and half our crew scattered after that lightning struck and the rest of us tried to put that last piece of tarp out. But anyway, the next day the Patriots were out early and I heard a guy calling back to their hotel saying the field's tarped, and everybody was so appreciative. The Cardinals and the Patriots players and coaches were just so appreciative that we spent the night painting the field and then we got the field tarped, to create a nice playing surface for them.
Do you do your own landscaping, your own lawn mowing and design at home, or how does that work?
I don't have any grass at home. I just have rocks and a pool. So, but my plants all look really healthy. And I do have 1 square foot of grass. On my last day of work at ASU, one of the last things that I did was take a plug of sod off the sidelines and bring it home.
Cool.
So I bought a little pot. And I have like 1 square foot of sod in a pot on my pool wall. So I've been maintaining that this last week. it doesn't take as much time as a whole field, but I've been watering it and nursing it along. So I'm kind of looking forward to keeping that alive and keeping it look good.
Good luck with what's next. That's Brian Johnson. He was a longtime head groundskeeper for ASU Athletics, just retired earlier this month. Brian, thanks so much for talking. I appreciate it.
Yep, you're totally welcome. Thank you.
It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. And now let's meet the next maker in our series, Made in Arizona.
Y'all ready for this?
Before the construction of any project, the architect carefully prepares working plans so that correct coordination of all trades is ensured.
Back in the materials research laboratory, every batch of material issued to the production line is carefully tested.
It's a busy machine and often a noisy one.
But there's room here for every type of artistic conception.
Nancy Hill likes to do things with her hands, the owner of Grand Avenue's one and only letterpress shop, Hazel and Violet. Hill spends her days printing everything from thank you cards and wedding invitations to posters and artwork using century-old presses, the old-fashioned way. It all started for her years ago when she and a friend decided on a lark to try letterpress and liked it.
I were doing corporate food service, company cafeterias, catering, things like that, all around. And we just decided we wanted to do a little something because we were only working 10 hours a day and we had extra time. So we were going to get a little tabletop press, but instead we found a guy in Apache Junction selling his press shop, which included that press over there and a bunch of type, not all of this, because as it turns out, after we got started, it's a disease. So now I have, you know, 7 presses and tons of type.
Letterpress is an analog way of printing in today's digital world, and it's a visceral process from setting the type to selecting the color of the ink to the texture of the paper. Our co-host Lauren Gilger got the chance to try it out with Hill recently and talk about why she's made letterpress into a career after starting it on a whim.
We liked paper. We liked typography. It sounded like fun. And it is fun. It is fun. And as it turns out, it's all the things I like. There's a little place for absolutely everything that I can put in there. And it's all very mechanical, you know, so it's I like it.
Is there something about the history of this that drew you to it?
It's an interesting history. I mean, you know, it's freedom of the press, you know, which doesn't really work unless you own one.
How old are some of these presses that you have here?
We have the main press that we bought is 100 this year. We're going to have a party. And one of them up front is a little older than that. And the rest are from the 60s, really, which to me is not old. But yeah, that's about the last time they were making them.
And they were used in newspapers, magazines, everything back then?
Well, the proof presses are used to proof something that may go into a publication and be printed on a larger press. These are production presses, and there's people all over the country that have presses like these that are, you know, we make wedding invitations, we make stationery, I make, you know, whatever people want.
So Hill showed me how one of her massive electric production presses works. It's a metal hulk of a machine, the size of a small golf cart that hums and clicks as it flips the paper throughout it and stamps down its type.
This one has type set up right there. And it prints.
Oh, wow. So the thing about letterpress, right, is that it's handmade, right? So people love that.
Handset type, and you can feel it.
Yeah, so it's indented.
Debossed. It's debossed.
And what's this monster over here? This one here is huge.
It is what we print anything that has high production or needs close registration for colors. Most of our wedding invitations are printed on this. And my pressman's a wood carver, so all of his wood carvings are printed on here. This is all suction here. So it sucks up the paper, the arms grab the paper, they drop it down, they print it, they pick it up, and puts it back over here.
Not all of her presses are so massive and mechanical, though. Next, Hill took me over to one of her proof presses, which was set up with poster-sized paper and type, spelling out a special message for First Friday revelers coming later that night.
So this press is a reprex, and it is a proof press, and there's ink on it, and you just roll it over the type.
Hell hath no fury.
You got it. These are not electric. This has a motor. But this one, for example, you use a hand brayer to put on the ink.
So you're rolling like a stamp pad sort of on ink here? You covered the letters there in the red ink here. Put the paper on top. And roll it. Tell me about some of the fonts involved in this, right? Like, if you like type, this is kind of the place to go.
Right. Yeah. We have a lot of, it looks like a lot of type. We hardly ever have what I want.
Because these are, what, hundreds of drawers here, it looks like.
There are.
What are some of your favorites?
My favorite is Cobble, which is this over here. But I also like Franklin, and I'm pretty fond of Garamond, which is over there. But, you know, we use different fonts for different things. For whatever we say, we get something that works for that.
But it's not just type, because you do a lot of images, and you said something about having someone who does wood carvings. Explain that.
Well, my pressman does wood carvings, and which is great. And I do some lino cutting, so we can get images that way. But most our images are what they call cuts, which are magnesium or zinc on wood. And they last, you know, forever.
Yeah.
A lot of them that I have are very, very old. I have no idea how old that is, but it's old. It enables us to, you know, make things with images on them.
What's the most popular thing? People want to come in and do this themselves. It's so visceral, right? Like turning that wheel, turning the machine.
It's very satisfying, you know, to think of what you want. Most people print quotes. And, you know, sometimes they're family quotes, but mostly they're just out there in the world quotes. And people feel great about being able to do it. You know, it's a very analog thing to do. And, you know, today it's nice to do something with your hands other than type.
There is something sort of trendy about that, maybe, is the word, right? Like that we do like today to sort of do something that is the opposite of what we do all the time, which is always digital.
Absolutely. Absolutely. People feel that. We do workshops for design firms and stuff, and designers come in and, you know, set type and print things, and, you know, they have a ball.
I wonder what you think the value is in that for folks. Like, do you think there's some sort of intrinsic value in doing something with your hands and creating something that is original?
Oh, I do. I mean, it's a hugely, hugely creative thing. And essentially, it's more creative than doing it on a computer. It's time-consuming, and, you know, your hands take some serious punishment. You always have ink on your hands, and I always wear black.
Is there a community of this around the country, around the world, of people who do what you do? I imagine it's one of those insidery worlds that you can get involved in.
There's thousands of letterpress printers, you know, thousands of them. Most of them in this country are, and probably all countries, are graphic designers also. You know, I am not. You know, so we all kind of know each other. There are huge conferences. They're called Ways Gooses.
So tell me a little bit about what's next then to end with. I mean, like, how long do you want to keep doing this and where do you envision it going?
I don't know. I'll keep doing it as long as I can keep doing it. I mean, it's a physical thing. So at some point I'll realize that I can't do it, you know, and I'll sell all this shit and move on.
All right, Nancy Hill, thank you so much for having me out. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks.
That'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. We, of course, hope you'll be back with us tomorrow morning. No invitation needed, embossed, letterpressed, or otherwise. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Have a great rest of your day. See you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Steve Goldstein. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, thanks for listening today.